The Tom Woods Show, episode 2317.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. So glad to talk to Bill Steigerwald. Bill, I've never had you on the show before, but we got to know each other quite some time ago. I want you to give people the specifics, but I knew you as a journalist in Pittsburgh, and you were sympathetic to what I was doing, and we got to know each other a bit. And just the other day, just yesterday's episode of the Tom Woods Show, I mentioned your name, and that's what made me think, why have I never had Bill on? Because we were talking about children's books that spread our ideas, and I know you've just recently written one. I want to talk about much more than just that, but I do want to start with that. You have a book called Grandpa Bear Goes to Washington, The Fantastic Voyage of a Freedom-Loving Polar Bear. And I mentioned that as soon as it came in the mail, you sent it to us. My wife read it, loved it, said it's the best of its kind. But first, you've had quite a long career as a journalist, mostly, I think, with Pittsburgh newspapers. So can you just fill in the blanks for us on that?
Sure. I actually started a weekly paper in Cincinnati, worked there for about a year. Moved out to L.A., got in a side door of the L.A. Times. There was no way they were going to hire me, but I literally got in a side door. And I worked there for 10 years as a copy editor, third string TV critic, book reviewer, feature writer. Then moved back to my native Pittsburgh in 1990, where I worked for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, which is an old morning paper. It was a Democrat, Clinton Democrat paper at the time. And then in 2000, I like to say I defected from the Post-Gazette and went across the river to the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, which was owned by Richard Mellon Scaife, and was, I would call it, conservative libertarian. So I was an associate editor there, but I did book reviews. I did hundreds of Q&As, including one with you in 2009. And I wrote a weekly op-ed column and did letters. And by the time 2009 came around, I was pretty much burned out from my career in journalism, which as a open libertarian, I was always alone, but also always having something to write about because everything at the LA Times, everything at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and most things, even at the conservative libertarian Trib, were not libertarian friendly. Editors and philosophies running those papers, that's for sure.
But somehow you survive. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But I love the premise. It's such an adorable premise to Grandpa Bear Goes to Washington. So can you give us a brief synopsis?
Sure. Grandpa Bear lives up in Greenland, and he has a daughter and a grandson. And Grandpa Bear is, oh, I don't know, I guess he'd probably be about 50 years old. He watches. You have to know that the unbeknownst to the environmentalists in the government and in the, down here in the States, that polar bears can talk, and they have quite a parallel existence, sophisticated parallel existence in the North. And Grandpa Bear and his fellow bears live in a little town, and they have a high school, and they have, what do you call it, snowmobiles and all kinds of stuff. And humans can't see them. Can't see their paraphernalia, their civilization. They can only see them as we see them, as bears. So the biggest threat to the polar bears these days is being placed on the endangered species list, which is what the politicians in Washington were doing. And I wrote this basically back in 2010, 2011, 2012, when they were trying to put the polar bear on the endangered species list. And I don't even know if they ever did succeed, but Grandpa Bear was not too thrilled with this because he knew it would mean that government people would come and take over their lives and ruin their lives, which were essentially free and unfettered and happy because they were not bothered by humans, not bothered by oil rigs or anything. They were quite friendly up there. And so Grandpa Polar Bear decides the only way he's going to convince the politicians in Washington that the polar bears do not need their help was to go there himself and speak in front of a Senate hearing as a witness, which he does. And, oh, I mean, it's silly, but I played it as straight as I could in terms of what was going on in Washington, what the Endangered Species Act would do. I had to look up how fast icebergs travel. They don't travel very fast, but we had a magical iceberg that Grandpa was able to pick, and it went faster than most of the other icebergs that flowed down from the Greenland Sea. And as it happens in my story, Washington, D.C. was locked into a terrible winter freeze, and basically the city was shut down, and Grandpa, his daughter, and his grandson get aboard this iceberg, pack their stuff in there, and sail down to Washington, walk up the frozen Potomac, change into their human clothes in the Jefferson Memorial, and then show up at this hearing. And once again, you got to play with all the things. Remember how Superman, what was it, Clark Kent wore those glasses, and for some strange reason, people couldn't see that Superman and Clark Kent were the same person, only because he had glasses on. Well, I played with that a little, I guess. And as long as Grandpa Jr. and Mother Polar Bear are wearing their magical glasses, they look like humans to humans. And if they take their glasses off, it becomes obvious to a human that they are talking to a polar bear and not a human. Anyway, it sounds silly. It is silly, but the message is pure libertarian. There's even a little homeschooling pitch in there. But I also make fun of the media and I have Anderson Cooper. I changed his name so I can hardly think of his straight name anymore. I call him Cooper Anderson or something, but Anderson Cooper. And when I was doing this, I got a young guy in Pittsburgh to do a bunch of sketches, and he turned Grandpa Bear into sort of a superhero. So he's big and brawny. I mean, polar bears are big. They can run fast. They would eat you and very quickly if they wanted to. And Grandpa Polar Bear was not only smart, not only libertarian, not only wise, but he was figure out how to basically bring his declaration of polar bear independence to the Senate and a Senate hearing. And the sketches really worked out well. They were really only sketches and he was going to fill them in. Then I lost track of them and I didn't use the sketches. And then I decided I'm going to make a book out of all this. And I put it all together last around Christmas time, Thanksgiving. And you can go on Amazon and create a book. And that's what I did. It cost me about $2 a copy. And I can't say it's selling like hotcakes, but I figured it's a little bit too sophisticated for kids, young kids. And it's, you know, adults like your beloved and blessed wife got it. She understood what was going on. And I think that there's enough adventure in it to carry the story. And I had fun and that's it.
Well, I think it can work, especially now that we have that Tuttle Twins series. We still need something for the older kids. And I think this fits that bill. And not to mention, I think the idea is it's a charming, entertaining story, but it implants in the mind of the reader the counterintuitive idea that government protection might actually be more trouble than it's worth, might actually cause more problems than it solves. You wouldn't think that, would you? You would think, oh, well, that'll be great if they get added to the endangered species list, because you don't know anything about that,
right,
what that implies. And so the fact that you tell that story is valuable because, of course, the insights you have about that are not confined just to the Endangered Species Act. These are lessons that we can apply to a lot of cases where the government is going to, quote unquote, help us, but maybe we would prefer to do without their help.
Yes. And as I say, Grandpa at the sports bar where they find out that polar bears are about to be placed on the endangered species list, they're watching a football game, the Chicago Bears, of course, and it's interrupted by a news flash from Washington. And there is, I guess, Senators Feinstein and what's his name from the late Nevada guy.
Oh, Harry Reid?
Yeah, Harry Reid, the ancient sunburned senator from Nevada. And they're going to introduce the legislation. And Grandpa knows right away. As I say, everybody quickly gathered around the wise old bear, for they understood he knew more than anyone about their proud species and the many dangers posed to them by humans. This is a very serious threat, Grandpa said grimly. If we are placed on that endangered species list, it will mean the end of our traditional way of life forever. And what do you mean? Someone asked. And Grandpa said, a plague of nature scientists, wildlife experts from the Interior Department, and celebrities from Hollywood will invade our land. They will tell us they are coming to protect us from the harmful effects of global climate change. But what they will really do is slowly take away our freedoms and take over our daily lives. They'll force us to change how we live, what we eat, and where we can travel. It'll be just like we were being kept in a zoo. So old Grandpa's pretty hip to what would happen when they're going to be helped by the federal government.
Right, right, right. So I'm going to link at tomwoods.com/2317. I'll link to your book, Grandpa Bear Goes to Washington. People should read it. It's well done. And as you say, there are valuable lessons in it, and it's well told. I want to talk about your career as a journalist, though, because you were a journalist during, I would say, during a pivotal moment in the world of journalism, because the development of the internet occurred really during that time.
Yes.
So we had that on the one hand. So I definitely want to talk about that. But also, you did quite a few Q&As with significant people. So certainly Ron Paul, but also Bill Buckley, Al Haig, John Taylor Gatto, Newt Gingrich, George McGovern, Robert McNamara, Christopher Hitchens, Pat Buchanan, whole bunch of people that you had an opportunity to talk to. Of all those, and you did hundreds of those, is there any particular one or handful that absolutely stand out to you that just blew you away?
Well, it's funny. I always think of, and this sounds strange, but maybe you probably know Pat Buchanan. He was always so charming and so friendly and so endearing. It was like I had known him all my life. Probably, I think I did 3, maybe 4 interviews with him over the years. Each time was better than the last. And he was just a great guy. But people like Christopher Hitchens was a real character, obviously. Did you ever meet him or see him, run into him?
No, I mean, as you say, I know Pat, and he's the opposite of what you would think based on what people say about him. He is like the nicest, sweetest guy in the world. Christopher Hitchens, I think, would be interesting to interact with, but I never have.
Well, he was an example of someone. I had seen him on C-SPAN a couple of times, and he was this surly, back in the late 90s, he was this surly ex-socialist, a recovering socialist, as Brian Lamb used to call him at CNN. And he just looked kind of a nasty statist, you know? I mean, somebody I wouldn't really like. I met him in Pittsburgh before I actually did Q&As with him, because he came to teach a class at Pitt. And we met him at lunch, and true to form, he got completely drunk. And we had to almost literally carry him, three of us, to his car.
Oh my gosh.
He couldn't have been nicer to us. He was, at the time, Christopher Hitchens, big time. He was hanging out with Vaclav Havel and everybody, and going to Hong Kong to make sure that the Chinese communists, you know, handed over the Brits handed over Hong Kong to the Chinese. And he treated us, we were Pittsburgh newspaper hacks, nobody special, 6 or 7 of us at a big table. He treated us like we were his peers. He couldn't have been a nicer guy. But when I think of all the people I did on phone calls, you know, and I remember calling Newt Gingrich once, and he was in Italy, and he was in a real pissy mood. And that was kind of funny, I thought, because I obviously forgot, and he was supposed to talk to me, and it was kind of like, ugh. But I met, not on the list that you just rattled off, but people like Jimmy Stewart and Peter Falk and Timothy Leary when I was in LA. Timothy Leary was another example of someone who I went to see in the year 1980. He was 60. And I thought he would be a nasty, American-hating, dangerous, subversive character. He makes Pat Buchanan look like a grumpy old man.
Oh, really?
He was the funniest, the most I always like to say I got drugs from Timothy Leary, because I had a headache, and he went in and got me some aspirin. We sat on his front step He lived in a condo in Beverly Hills. You could hear the sirens and everything. And he was very happy to tell me that he spent most of his days teaching the Iranian kids in the neighborhood how to play baseball. And he sat there and he couldn't have been nicer. And I've yet to unleash, that's really strange, I have yet to unleash that interview with him, which was probably 40 minutes. And I'm just sort of saving it. I've been trying to archive my stuff on my Substack site just so I have it there. And then I'm trying to figure out if there's a book, because Amazon makes it so easy, a book that I could assemble my best Q&As. And I mean, we're talking Alexander Haig and George McGovern was great.
You're talking about people who made American history in some cases. These are very significant people. And it's funny you mentioned George McGovern. I was going to ask you about him next because he fascinates me. I mean, I was born the very year he ran for president. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't really around during the McGovern era, but he was still a public figure, really almost right up to his death in 2012. He was writing books into the mid-2000s and stuff. So I'm curious about what you thought about him. I feel like I don't agree with him on a lot of things, but yet I have this sense that he was more reasonable and humane than a lot of people in the Democratic Party these days.
Yes. I think it's really kind of weird. If you live long enough, and I'm 75, so I've been around, and I cast my first vote, I hope you don't tell anyone, for Richard Nixon in 1968. And then I learned my lesson, never voted for a major party person after that. But when I talked to McGovern, it was in 2004, and it was the Democrat National Convention was coming up. And my boss said, you know, who can we talk to that's a Democrat that's out there that, you know, somebody different? And he came up with the name George McGovern. I said, okay, let me go try to find him. This was 2004, and this is when I realized how amazing the internet really was. I had interviewed by then still dozens, scores of people. So this was nothing new to chase down George McGovern. I went back to my desk, sat at my desk, opened my computer, did a search for George McGovern, saw that he taught at a school in South Dakota, saw a phone number, picked up my phone, called the number. I said, I'm trying to track down George McGovern. Does he teach there? Do you have a number for him? And she said, well, here, try this number. She gave me the number. I hung up the phone with her. I picked up the phone. I dialed the number. George McGovern picked up the phone.
That's just crazy.
And he was in Montana somewhere. And I mean, I didn't have any questions prepared for him. So I went like, what do I do now? I got George McGovern on the phone. You're always afraid when you get somebody important and obviously or historical or whatever, that you're going to blow it because you're not prepared. Well, I set up a time and talked to him the next day, and he was great. And what was funny about him was that after he got out of politics, he had some deal. He was running a hotel or like a resort hotel somewhere in New England. And he started going off on how horrible it was that the regulators were torturing him and his business. And
I remember he wrote about this. Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's pretty funny. And so there's George McGovern confessing to something that not one Democrat even understood, much less would complain about. So he was great. And, it never, ever ends. And it was a lot of fun. Deepak Chopra, it wasn't always politics, which made it nice. So I could call anybody, really, that made any sense. David McCullough, the historian, he's from Pittsburgh. So we always had that connection. And I don't know, name anybody, think tank people and authors. It was a great thing to do for a newspaper. And I like to think that although I didn't invent the format for sure, I sure did popularize it. I was doing Q&As. Sergei Khrushchev came to the city of Pittsburgh in the late 90s to teach a class. This is Nikita's son, the missile expert, I think he was. He came to Pittsburgh to give a talk at Carnegie Mellon. And I saw that he was coming, and I thought, oh, he would be a great guy to try to talk to. So I arranged a Q&A, a phone Q&A with him. So you never knew who you would come across, PJ or Warp, George Will, anybody who came to give a speech in Pittsburgh, a lecture kind of thing, or anybody who had just written a book. Anyone who writes a book, as you know, is at the mercy of the media. And so, they might, I'm sure they have a contract that says you got to talk to anybody who wants to publicize your book, right? And so they were always easy people to get. I tried to get Obama in 2007, probably, and I had one of his people on the phone, but it never came through. That would have been a good little catch.
Yeah.
But not Hillary. I met Hillary in person and wrote a little thing about that. But I don't know, a lot of people, it goes on and on and on, whether it's movie stars when I was out in L.A., Peter Falk and people like that, Jimmy Stewart. I would always ask them about their politics, which I thought was good. But I thought the Q&A format was good for newspapers because I was always aware of the subjectivity of journalism, despite their pretensions. And I got into newspapers or into journalism. I was a William F. Buckley conservative at the time, and I felt like there weren't enough people like me who thought that way in journalism. And that was one of the things I wanted to do, was sort of insert my ideas. Well, I left Buckley, who I did interview for maybe one of his last interviews right before he died. I went from Buckley, I'd be reading National Review and I'd see names like von Mises and Hayek, and I'd say, who are these guys? You know, and I'd go off. And by the time I talked to Buckley at the end there, I wasn't too fond of him or his ideas. He was a wonderful man. He was very gracious. He helped me put on my raincoat. Timothy Leary gave me an aspirin. So I have all these little memories of these people. But the Q&A format gave me, first of all, the power to get some very important and interesting people and to ask questions and get their ideas into the paper, whether it was Charles Murray or Deepak Chopra or whoever. I would ask questions. I wasn't there to interrogate them or to argue with them, but I would try to say, you know, one of my best was Robert McNamara, and he had a book out. So he was at my mercy, and I asked him questions. And I would say, you know, here's what they're saying about your book. Here's what they're saying. Why didn't you tell us in 1967 what you knew about Vietnam and its failure at the time? And you can get that stuff in the paper. And I'm there, but I'm not there because I'm asking the questions. I can control the a little bit, but I wasn't calling him a baby killer or an evil man, which he may well have been. So it was always interesting, but I always was in the position where I was a libertarian. I was working for a liberal newspaper who really didn't even know what a libertarian was. And when libertarians would come anywhere near town, like Charles Murray, I would make sure to interview them so that I would get them in the paper. And in the year 2000 or 1995, whenever I talked to Charles Murray, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette had 230,000 readers in the morning. Now it has probably less than 100,000. So that was the golden age of newspapers that I did all this stuff, which again, I feel very, very fortunate about. The LA Times, if you were anywhere in California and you said, yeah, this is Bill Steigerwald, I'm with the LA Times, you got people on the phone, you got answers. It truly was an amazingly powerful
calling card, really.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah, calling card's good. Yeah, that's part of the problem now. And I always feel like I should have hooked up with somebody after I quit newspapers in 2009, that I should be affiliated with someone, even if it's just like Reason Magazine or some website, so that I can call and say, yeah, this is Bill Steigerwald, I'm doing a story for, because it gives you an entree that otherwise you can't. It's very important to have that clout behind you, whether it was in LA or in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, the Post-Gazette and the Trib were both relevant at the time. They are irrelevant today. They had political, if not power, certainly persuasiveness in terms of, you know, exposing or attacking city plans and stuff like that. And now I don't know what would happen if the city of Pittsburgh wanted to clear cut 10 downtown blocks the way they wanted to do in the year 2000. It was essentially stopped by a bunch of forces. It was like a 1960s urban renewal fiasco coming back to life in the year 2000. And it was stopped. The Institute for Justice, local property owners, me. I got the Institute for Justice to come here to represent the property owners who were going to be wiped out to build this horrible project. But the papers had power then, and they were able to help stop that. Today, I don't think they could do anything.
Well, let's talk about that, because you really were writing during the heyday of newspapers, and you also were an eyewitness to the transformation of the transmission of news because of the disruption caused by the internet. Now, did that have any personal effect on you as a journalist?
It was funny. I was getting a little bit burned out at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in 1999 or so. And that's when I was thinking of jumping, because they wouldn't let me be a columnist. They knew my politics. They knew I was a libertarian. Anybody who knows me, and if they read any of my features, hundreds of features, they'd know that there was a libertarian hiding in the woodwork somewhere. But in 1999, the Post-Gazette, in a really hapless way, tried to join the internet and created a website and started, basically they would just take what was in the paper and shovel it into a computer and put it up online. It was very little difference between the print and the electronic versions. Anyway, I said, let me work for them because I think that this is a pretty cool thing. And yeah, I was new and I wanted to be in on it. And I was in on it. And after about 3 months, I said, this will never work because the people running it are still newspaper people. They had no idea what they were doing. They had no idea how to take advantage of the internet. They didn't understand it. They didn't like it. Even the people doing it didn't really like it. The people in charge of this Nation Post-Gazette website, they would actually say things to me. I would say, look, okay, we're doing a story about the Pittsburgh Pirates. We need to have a link to the Pirates, Pittsburgh Pirates team website, and maybe to the Sports Illustrated story that's also written about. And they said, no, you can't put those links in the story because that'll take people away from the page.
Yeah.
And they had no idea that the reader was the person who was supposed to be served, and you should have as much information, as much links, and as much connections to things as you can throw in there. So that the readers know, the reader's going to come back and he's going to more likely come back if he knows that when he goes there in the first place that he's going to find all kinds of links to other places. Anyway, they had no clue. And it didn't get any better, really, for the Post-Gazette. And the business model was destroyed by the internet. They lost their classifieds. They lost a lot of their other ads. They lost all the sports and everything else. Newspapers were already heard by TV. But TV and newspapers should have and could have worked together very well, but they didn't, not in Pittsburgh. And I don't think they did very well anywhere else either.
But the key thing was that newspapers were trying to charge for what other people were now giving away for free. And how are they going to compete
yes.
with that?
And the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and KDKA, which was a major TV and radio power in the city for 100 years, should have been working together to bring all the news and opinion that they could possibly bring to the Pittsburgh market. And they didn't. They had a very, very slender connection. I used to tell the people at the Post-Gazette, look, they had a relationship with TV, but they wouldn't tell them TV what the big story was going to be tomorrow because they didn't want to be scooped. And I said, look, if you could pay KDKA to take the next day's Post-Gazette and hold it up in front of the camera at 11 o'clock the night before and say, this is going to be the biggest story in the history of Pittsburgh. It's in the Post-Gazette tomorrow. Here it is. They should pay for that. They wouldn't even tell. They would actually hide the big stories from their partner. So they didn't understand marketing or advertising or synergy or anything. And I'm no marketing guy, but it was so awful. They had made money. Newspapers were one of the most profitable businesses in America for 100 years. If you look back and saw like Gannett and Knight Ridder and those corporations that owned hundreds of papers, their net profit was in the low 20s, high teens. And that was at a time when the average corporation was net maybe 6% or something. So they had all the money in the world. They had virtual monopolies over the information. They didn't get the internet. And not only did they not know how to exploit it, they were destroyed by it and disrupted to the point where there's no reason to buy a Pittsburgh paper. Because one of the things is, too, they should have been focusing on local and on analysis and long-form stories. If you don't think there's a nice story in Pittsburgh about the demise of the public school system or the corruption involved in the Urban Renewal Administration's handling of thousands of properties that it's accumulated over the years, you know, in the city, and it goes on and on and on, right? Any city is full of stuff. That's what the Post-Gazette should have been focusing on as the internet came along, because TV and radio and then the internet were taking care of all the breaking news. Post-Gazette will never break another story, and it was true in 2000, will never break another story because of all the other media, but they didn't know how to do it. And they just held on, and their profits disappeared, and they their employees disappeared and their power and their relevancy disappeared. All didn't even take 20 years. It's probably gone in 10 years.
Well, this changes the landscape completely for anybody who wants to be a journalist. So I wonder, as somebody who was part of it before and after this major disruption, what your advice would be? Because right now, there are big online media services like The Daily Caller and Daily Wire and Breitbart, and let's say for people who are right of center,
right,
and you could just send them directly there and tell them to pursue their career there, or they could go to a traditional newspaper and see if they can make something of it in spite of the challenges. What would your advice be?
It's funny. I was both a feature writer, but I was also very much an opinion writer. I wanted to get into newspapers because I wanted to insert my crazy opinions into the body of the paper and get it out there. And you can be a good writer in college. And, you know, if you go to college and you work on the school paper, which too often, I think, try to be like the New York Times when they should be more like an alternative paper, a paper based on the campus, concerned about kids, not about the administration of the college. I mean, it's all upside down. The college papers are usually absolutely horrible. At least they were 15 years ago when I was looking at it. And I can't see that they got any better. But to learn how to write, opinion is one thing. But to write a feature, a simple thing like covering a fire, you cannot be sitting at a desk in front of a computer. You cannot be on the phone. You've got to go to the fire to see it right and to see it clear and to meet the people that you are never going to meet on the phone, because you can be standing there watching the fireman putting out the fire, and the next door neighbor comes wandering by and she tells you this sob story about something or other. Well, you ain't going to get that when you're talking on the phone to the fire chief saying how many alarms the fire was. So being on the ground is so important for any journalist. And I think if you look around, the best journalists are on the scene, are in the middle of the action. They're not on a phone somewhere. So it's kind of tough to learn how to write. Well, you need to write. And you need to cover a lot of different things. You need to know how to interview people, but you also know how to use your senses and also carry a little philosophical voice in your head that maybe if you go see a bunch of immigrants and you can see, you know, like, well, here's a good story, here's a wrong story. But if you're sort of pro-immigration or anti, that's going to come out in your, can come out in your coverage. Newspapers don't pretend to be objective anymore. They're more advocates now. It's terrible, including all the way up to the New York Times, which used to be a source of honest reporting anyway, or fair and balanced as much as you could ask for in most cases, the New York Times. But I think now it's just all advocacy. But so for someone today to go, I know my daughter, she could get hired by the, what's that place out in Vancouver, the Canadian think tank out there, and never leave her house in Pittsburgh and write for them for years or something. So if you want to be a journalist, it's more than opinions, and you have to do reporting. And it's just a shame because there's nothing more fun. And I had so much fun, whether I went to Croatia to cover a story or whether I went chasing tornadoes in Nebraska and Kansas, which I did twice. Not only did I have the adventure, it was paid for by someone else. And I knew that whatever I saw and recorded was going to show up on the front page of the paper the next day, and my mother was going to read it. And after a while, I learned everything I learned on the job. And after a while, the terror of writing a deadline story, and also the fear that I wasn't writing in the proper Columbia School of Journalism certified journalism 101 way, because I wrote more like a magazine person. So I was extremely lucky. I was extremely lucky at the LA Times and Pittsburgh Post-Gazette to almost always be in charge of what I wrote about. I bet you I didn't have 500 words of all the millions of words that I wrote ever changed by an editor. And that is rare. And I don't know how I did it. Just, I can read stuff now that I wrote 40 years ago, and I'm thinking, man, that's pretty good. And I couldn't do that today if you paid me $10,000.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you mentioned practice, which to my mind is the key, is you just have to do it over and over again. to become a good writer, you have to do a lot of writing. And I think another way to become a good writer is not only to practice, but to practice with a word count limit, because then you become a concise writer, which is what separates you from the average writer who thinks that a lot of flowery language is going to make their writing better. No, it makes it much, much worse. But
yes,
apart from practice, what do you think was maybe one or two insights or factors that led to making you a good writer?
I guess I've always been observant. I've always been opinionated. To be a good writer, you just need information, right? You need to say, well, look, that guy's shoes are like he's got two different shoes on, or the, you know, the little kid has no shoes. You know, you see things, you have to understand whether it means anything or not. And again, as I say, just being there, you have to be there. Obviously, you couldn't chase tornadoes for 2 weeks without being there. And you see the crazy knucklehead tornado chasers and what they do. And you do loyal stories and you tell their stories and their backgrounds. And then you watch them in action and all that stuff. But I can't separate myself from what I did in the sense that it seemed natural to me that when you went somewhere, you wrote everything down in a notebook. I mean, as much as you could, that's limited. And you know what to write down, and you know that the people you talk to have to trust you. So you can't go in there like you're the big shot and you're going to expose something or be mean to them. You have to be a human being in your relationship with them. And in fact, I often would feel like I'd say, you know, don't tell me that. I don't need to know that kind of personal stuff. You don't need to go there. And it's surprising what people will tell you when you're standing there with a notebook, one of those reporter's notebooks in your hand. So there weren't any epiphanies. You know, it wasn't like one day I thought, oh, so this is how you do it. It was a process that just evolved. And the more I did, the better I got at it. And the more interviews I did, the better I got at that. And I have still hundreds of legal pads with my questions. I would have Tom Woods at the top, and then I'd have a bunch of questions, and then I'd number them like, oh, this should be the first one. This will be the last one. These will be in the middle, wherever they fit in. And I would go through that because that way I knew I would get answers to the questions I needed to get answered in a news sense. And I wouldn't be stumbling around thinking, well, you know, are you married? You know, I knew stuff. You did a lot of preparation before you did the Q&As. It's almost a formula to do them. It works. It worked with everybody ever did, with except Ralph Nader. It was so mean. I talked to Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader, and I wanted to ask them each the same question about third parties. And I would ask, not simultaneously, obviously, but I would have Buchanan. I'd ask him seven or eight questions. I'd get Nader and ask him exactly the same questions, and I would put them parallel on the paper. And I just remember Nader being really pissy about it, and he somehow thought I was going to talk about X, and I was talking about Y, and he fought me the whole way. So you never know, but he was like the only cantankerous person I ever talked to. But he was nice. He was Ralph Nader. I mean,
I had a chance to interview him too, and it was cordial enough, and we focused on areas of agreement, and that was very gratifying. I'll say, maybe this is a story. I can't tell if listeners are getting tired of hearing it. I don't remember if I've actually told it on the show. I think I might have written it down. But for me, because I kind of make my living through writing too. I do most of my writing to my newsletter list these days, but I've written a lot of books and stuff like that. And I think a lot of times we look back on our formal education and we think, most of what I do now, I learned on my own. I didn't really get it from my formal education. But one thing I will absolutely credit to my formal education was the first step toward making me a much, much better writer. And it came in junior year of high school. And I was taught by Margaret Hannum at North Andover High School in her AP English class. And I wrote my first paper for her. I will never forget this, Bill, as long as I live. I got a C on that paper. And let me tell you something. Old Woods here did not get C's on papers. This was not supposed to happen. And I could not get over the injustice. Doesn't she know I'm Tom Woods and I do not get a C on my paper? But I went through and I looked at all her comments, and her main gripe was that the paper was not concise. There were so many unnecessary words. And those unnecessary words make your writing read like molasses. Mm-hmm. And when you brutally remove them, now I'm not saying that you have to write like Ernest Hemingway, but you have to know when a word is absolutely necessary. And then you get to the next level of what is the precise word I need that conveys the shade of meaning I want. That's when you become an elegant writer. But the first step is brutally taking a machete to those sentences and hacking away at all the unnecessary words. So she gave me an opportunity to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. And I thought there was something wrong with her. I thought she's taking my wonderful writing and making it bad. No. She was taking my bad writing that I, as an amateur, thought was good writing and making it great. And after she retired, this was, I don't know what year she retired, long after I left, she, I believe, moved to Pennsylvania. And I don't know how I can contact her, but I have always wanted to tell her. And she'd probably be horrified. I'm sure she has the same political views as most English teachers. So if she knew she unleashed Tom Woods on the world, I don't know that she would consider that an unmixed blessing. But all the same, I would love to tell her that it did not fall on deaf ears, that I attribute a good, good chunk of my skill to that kick in the pants she gave me.
Mm-hmm. That is very important. And, you know, journalism is that every day. They had guys on the desk. I mean, the way newspapers were structured, and I don't think this will ever be repeated again, it was like an army. You had the big editor, then you had the sub-editors, and then you had like the department editors, and then you had the reporters, the little troops, and they went out and did the stories, and they brought them in, and they handed them in to the sub-editor, and they looked at it. In the end, though, that was all sent to a copy editor at the city desk or at the copy desk. And those were people whose whole reason for living was to do what that teacher did to you, is to take out the unnecessary words. Now, that was old school. And there was always this clash between there's the editor's paper and there's the writer's paper. And I guess I think the New York Times was always considered a writer's paper, and so was the LA Times. In other words, their writers were given a lot of leeway. If they turned in a story, it was not meddled with. They didn't change the lead. They didn't rip it apart and change stuff around. It was pretty much the way it was written. I was lucky that I was a magazine type writer. I was in every story, whether it was overt or sort of subversive, and I was not subjected to what could happen. Except one time I did a story and it didn't quite fit because it was supposed to be, you know, they did everything column inches. So let's say it was 30 inches and I wrote 30 inches, but it turned out that they could only take 20, 25. So this poor copy editor thought he was doing a favor. Instead of taking a paragraph or two or three out to meet the required length, he went through my entire story and took out, I'm not kidding, every single word that was not necessary.
Oh.
And it read like the phone book. I mean, to me, I was like,
No, you can't do that. No, I agree. You absolutely can't do that.
So that was one extreme. The other extreme is, at the LA Times, they used to laugh because they had these hotshot star reporters, and they would write pieces that would go on. They would jump from they'd go start on page one. They'd jump four times inside, you know, the front section, and because no one ever touched a word. And they were the stars, and their way, way, way too long copy was sacrosanct, and it became a joke, really. Well over all the big ads of the day, because they could run it across the tops of the ads forever. But
well, I know that, of course, being a good writer is not just grammar and stuff, but I will say that what they teach you in school, when they try to give you hard and fast rules, that half the time you really shouldn't treat as hard and fast rules. Like, they want to suggest to you, I don't know if you got this in school, but they had like a jihad against the passive voice.
Yeah.
But sometimes the passive voice is the most elegant way to convey what you're saying.
Yes.
And yet you don't use a passive voice all the time, but sometimes it's called for. But this mercilessly uprooting all examples of the passive voice was wrong. And then I remember another time we were told, okay, write an essay and make sure you have an adjective in front of every noun. And I thought, this is the dumbest exercise in the history of the world. Nobody puts an adjective in front of every noun. Why are you doing this to me? This
yeah,
is like,
right.
Don't make me write like a robot if you don't want me to sound like a robot.
Well, you know, and I was a copy editor at the LA Times, but I was able to freelance a lot of those other stories. But copy editors were infamously tight-butted, tight-assed in their what they would do to people's copy. And they had all these rules that they enforced that would drive me crazy. And one of them, I remember, I went and did a story about a local story. And it was a mayor of a municipality on the Mon River in Pittsburgh. It was an old mill town. And this guy wanted to have a police force and he really couldn't afford it. So he somehow came up with enough money to hire a policeman. He got a car, a used police car with 250,000 miles on it. He hired police and he paid them the minimum wage, right? And this one cop, one policeman. Anyway, the headline that I wrote was a minimum wage cop. It was what the whole story was about. And in those days, even though there was the show Cops on TV, the copy editor would not allow us to use the word cop because it was not a nice way to refer to a police officer. So I wrote a sentence that said he was a such and such cop, a buy your own vest, buy your own gun, such and such minimum wage cop, right? Well, I ended up with one cop and two police officers, which destroyed my wonderful paragraph, whatever my paragraph was, you know, it was destroyed. And at that time in the late 90s is when you could see, looking back, you could see the emergence of sort of the politically correct, woke kind of influence. You were not allowed to use the word pimp. We were not allowed to use the word poor. And the LA Times, I wish I could get a hold of it. There's a 19-page pamphlet they put out in the late 90s that of all the words you should not use. And they include, did I say powwow and Dutch treat? I mean, they were out of their minds trying to rat out every possible word that might offend anyone anywhere.
And I've never met a Dutch person offended by Dutch treat.
I know. Some of them were like, come on, you know? But those rules, that etiquette or whatever they would call it, was started to pop up just as the ship, I called it the Daily Titanic. And as the newspaper business was in its sinking stage, got stupider and stupider, I think. It was so antiquated, again, because it was such a good business model for so long, so profitable, so rich. Go find a 1946 paper from little towns that don't even have a post office anymore. You know, they're like 12 pages, but a big city paper like the Post Gazette had 88 pages. Each page was the size of a half of a refrigerator, you know, not like the little postage stamp size papers that they have now. And it had so much information. You could follow World War II. They had maps of World War II, the battles in Europe, and all the stuff going on in the Connellsville, PA Gazette or whatever it was. All that is gone. And it's a shame because it'll never come back. There'll never be a paper like the Post Gazette that had 200 of us covering virtually every school board meeting, every council meeting in the whole area. And we're talking probably 100 municipalities. Everyone was covered either by someone like me or a stringer whose whole job was to go to every meeting, see what was going on, write up a report, and a little football games and everything else in those communities. All of that is gone. None of that is being done by any newspaper and never will be again.
Well, Bill, I'm going to, on our show notes page, link to your Substack and also link to your wonderful book, Grandpa Bear Goes to Washington. Show notes page is tomwoods.com/2317 for episode 2317. And I think this was sort of my opportunity to do a Q&A with you, Bill, returning the favor after all those years. So thanks for taking the time to do it.
Well, thank you for doing it. I always used to think when I interviewed all these people, I said, man, these guys are good. They have these great answers for all this stuff. Of course, there were people I had to type up. I had to transcribe all this stuff too, by the way. And I just remember there were two people who stand out to me who were always bad. One was Santorum, Rick Santorum. And the other was, well, never mind. I can't think of his name. But Santorum, you know, when you type it out, you're going, gee, what? I got to put in periods. I got to like separate stuff out and try to figure out what's. But most people had great answers, including you, obviously. And Milton Friedman was the best. I didn't change one word in my 20-minute interview with him.
Well, if I know that I'm doing an interview that's going to be transcribed, I try my best to be conscious of the carelessness of the spoken word and try to speak in paragraphs to the best of my ability so as to make it as easy as possible on the poor interviewer.
That's true. Well, that's good of you because I know that I ramble and it's hard not for me to ramble. And I can be very, very precise in my writing, and in my blabbing, it's not as precise. But anyway, I do what I do. I've been on a couple of shows. I was on with Brian Lamb once in a Q&A. You've probably been on there, right?
With C-SPAN?
Yeah.
I've been on C-SPAN a bunch of times, but not with him.
Oh, okay. It's up online somewhere. It was with my Steinbeck book where I exposed the lies and fictions in John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie book. So, and for some reason, Brian Lamb was very interested in that. And I drove down and sat there, and that was terrifying to me. So it's always terrifying. I'm glad it's over.
Yep.
We're great. I'm thankful that you and your wife were smitten by my little book, which who knows what will become of it.
I hope people check it out and enjoy it. Again, the link will be tomwoods.com/2317. Thanks again, Bill.
Okay, Tom, take care.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.